Welcome to the Free Will Show, a podcast that provides a beginner-friendly introduction to free will while also exploring cutting-edge developments on the topic. I'm Taylor Sear.
And I'm Matt Flummer. In this episode, we talk with Megan Griffith about developing a narrative capacity and how it relates to becoming morally responsible.
Thanks for listening. I'm happy to introduce Megan Griffith, professor of philosophy at Davidson College. Megan specializes in metaphysics, free will, moral responsibility, and action theory, and she's written an excellent introduction to free will with Rutledge called Free Will, The Basics. The second edition of this came out in 2022. Megan's also the co-editor with Neil Levy and Kevin Timpey of the Rutledge Companion to Free Will, which came out in 2017 and has been mentioned several times on this podcast already. Megan's also published several articles and book chapters that will be of interest to our listeners. Some of those papers focus specifically on the role that narrative plays in our coming to be morally responsible agents. And Megan has generously agreed to talk with us about that topic today. So welcome to the show, Megan. Could you start by telling us a bit about yourself, your work, and how you came to be interested in working on issues related to free will?
Yeah, sure. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here. You covered a lot of the stuff about me. I teach at Davidson, all of those sort of research interests. So I'll just talk a little bit about how I think I came to be interested in free will. It's hard to remember sometimes.
Sure.
It probably started when I went to grad school. My very first semester, I took an action theory course, and it was sort of classic 20th century action theory, you know, Davidson and Anscombe and people like that. Mm-hmm. And it was a kind of a revelation. Like, what is this? This is fascinating. And so that, I think, kind of started my interest down that road. And then I took an independent study with the late, great Veer Chappell in historical theories of action, so Aquinas and Hobbes and people like that. And I just loved all the intricate stuff about will and motivation mm-hmm. and desire and freedom. Mm-hmm. And then I came to like metaphysics and, you know, during the pre-dissertation phase, we had to do an oral exam on a bunch of readings. And so I got recommendations from faculty for some of the standard free will, moral responsibility literature. Mm-hmm. Lots of great people who you all know, like John Fisher and, mm-hmm. You know, Watson and people like that. And I really just liked the idea that you could combine my interest in metaphysics and action theory and human motivation and decision-making and psychology and all of these things sort of come together in the general vicinity of free will and responsibility. So it just was a really good fit.
Yeah, very cool. Yes. Mm-hmm. You've argued that narrative plays an important role in our mental lives and in becoming fully fledged, morally responsible agents. Before we get into the connection with moral responsibility, could you tell us a little bit more about what you mean by narrative?
Yeah, sure. And this is a really good question because we all have a sense for, you know, what a story is or what a narrative is, but it's hard to sometimes pin down what that means. And so I basically look to a lot of philosophers who've done work in this area over the years, and people like J. David Velleman and John Fisher again, and Connie Rosati and Maria Schechtman, and lots of great people who've used narrative in different contexts. And the thing that I think is most central for my purposes is that it's what Rosati calls a meaning-affecting relation. So if you have one thing or event, that's going to mean something depending on its connection to other events. And it's each event sort of conditions the others. So it's kind of a special relationship that's not completely encompassed by just saying, oh, one thing caused another thing. Mm-hmm. And one of the best examples, I think, of this is one that David Velleman talks about that he gets from Aristotle. And this is, there's a statue of a deceased man named Midas, and the statue falls on somebody and kills them. But the story part of it is that, you know, it might just seem like a weird tragic accident, but actually, the bystander who's killed by the statue is the murderer of Midas. So the guy who murdered Midas is killed by Midas's statue. And so now we have a whole new meaning for this event of the statue falling. If we didn't know that about the about how, you know, who killed Metis, we wouldn't think the same thing. And so it doesn't even have to be a causal relation. It's just an interesting story because these two events mean something different in the context of the other. And so Velleman uses that example to make his case about narrative. And I think that's a really helpful example. And Velleman also says there's kind of a, not just this meaning affecting and sense making, but there's also kind of like an emotional cadence that we feel with most narratives, that it's familiar, kind of has an emotional resonance for us. Mm-hmm. A more mundane example, not quite as maybe interesting as the Aristotle one, but so if I could say, suppose an event is me bringing you a box of peanut butter cookies, and that's an event. And you say, well, okay, how do we assess or analyze or interpret this event? Well, it's really going to depend on the context. So if we're looking to the past, we might say, well, maybe in one context, in one story, this would be me performing an act of gratitude because maybe you did something nice for me a couple weeks ago and I want to, you know, repay the favor, or I want to just show you that I really appreciated it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or maybe in the past we were fighting and I want to sort of, it's like an olive branch, it's a peace offering, mm-hmm. something like that. But if we're thinking about, you know, maybe there's a context that refers to the future. So maybe I'm going to ask you for a big favor in a couple weeks. And I'm thinking, oh, this will sort of, you know, butter them up. So I'll, mm-hmm. you know, give them this gift and they'll be more inclined to do this thing for me later that I'm planning on asking. And in a kind of maybe more bizarre case, but a the way action theory cases are always violent, I'll use this sort of case. It's kind of a funny side of action theory.
It is.
It might be, you know, it could be an act of revenge on my part. So suppose that you did something bad to me in the past, and I know you're allergic to peanut butter. And so I'm like, hey, here's some great cookies. And so then it would be an act of revenge because of that context. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of idea with narrative, is that you're taking an event or an action or something, and you're saying that it means something based on its relation to past or future events. And that's the sort of philosophical understanding of narrative. But in psychology, there's a kind of notion that I think goes along with the philosophical, and that is that we do sort of cognitively, we have this ability to reason or think in a narrative way. Mm-hmm. So if we take all of that stuff about the meaning affecting relation, and then we think in terms of psychology, we think, well, how is it, like, what is it that we're doing when we understand these relationships? And so psychologists have said, and I'm not an expert in psychology, of course, but my understanding is that psychologists, going back to people like Jerome Bruner, say it's a mode of thought. Narrative reasoning is a special mode of thought. And he talked about how it has to do with the landscape of action and the landscape of consciousness. So the idea is that narrative reasoning is a way of thinking about things in terms of action and in terms of consciousness. But what that means is you're thinking in terms of other people's states of mind, their beliefs, their desires, their intentions. So it's really starting to talk specifically about action and agency, looking at goal-directed behavior, looking at animate objects as opposed to inanimate objects, things like that. The psychologists also say that it may have some connection to our judgments of empathy, because when we understand this landscape of consciousness, then we understand what somebody else is feeling or believing or thinking. Mm-hmm. I like to think, sort of putting all these things together, I like to think of it as a kind of skill or a know-how. Victoria McGeer has she's a philosopher that has a kind of similar idea about certain things. It's not about narrative per se, but she talks about insider expertise. And I think that's a nice way of thinking of our narrative know-how, is that we're sort of we're reading and interpreting the world and other people's behavior, but we're doing it from the standpoint of people who can write our own behavior. So it's that kind of skill that I think we have when we have a kind of narrative skill. And there's different levels that we can get as we go through development.
Yeah. Well, I was just about to ask a little bit about that, about how this develops and how it's related to something like self-control. So in some of your work, you draw from developmental psychologists in particular to talk about how this narrative capacity arises, how it's related to developing self-control. Could you say a bit about how and when this narrative capacity develops?
Yeah, and I think this is really, really interesting. And again, I'm not the expert on this, of course, but what I've gleaned from reading some of the psychology is that between the ages of 1 and 3, children start developing this understanding of the landscape of action. And the way they know this, I think, is that, you know, a typical 1-year-old will balk at the fact that a step is missing from a really standard action sequence. Mm-hmm. So if they give them some sort of sequence that's really familiar, but they skip a step, the child will respond to that. And so they're starting to get this idea of what the landscape of action looks like,
right?
With goal-oriented behavior. And then children seem to learn this by a process that psychologists talk about as scaffolding. And Robin Fibish gives this example of, suppose that you have an 18-month-old that says, just kind of spontaneously, berries. Like, they're not eating berries or anything. They just say that. And the caregiver will then sort of fill in the story. They'll say, oh, yes, you're right. We had berries earlier today. Wasn't that fun? Or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And so kids start to learn how to build their memories and things like that into story structure. And typically by the age of around 5 years old, they can put things into a problem resolution story structure. So it's not just like stringing together events in terms of cause and effect or timing or whatever. It's really more story-like, because it's like, oh, this person has a problem and they're working on this goal and here's the resolution. And then according to some theorists there, they get to be almost as good as a typical adult by ages, say, 9 to 11. Now, that doesn't mean that their stories or their understandings are as coherent as the typical adults on a number of dimensions, but they're pretty good at the story structure, problem resolution structure, and understanding that sort of thing. It's also really interesting to note, there's a psychologist named Dan McAdams who has what he calls a life story model of identity. And he has this idea that people sort of forge their selfhood or their identity around this idea of a life story. And he says it's really not until adolescence that children are motivated and able to start integrating all these different sorts of events into a life story, which seems surprisingly late, but but it's kind of interesting that, you know, it's not that smaller, younger children can't think about like, oh, what I want to be when I grow up or that kind of thing. But adolescence, he thinks, is really the time when children say things like, oh, this is why I am the way I am. This is what I believe. And this happened to me before. And that's shaping me now. And they sort of build this whole sort of narrative, or as opposed to the sort of more discrete, simpler narratives that were possible when they were younger. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the developmental story, I think. And then in terms of self-control, I think this is really partly that as children learn some of this narrative know-how, they have access to self-control strategies that they wouldn't have otherwise had. Mm-hmm. And there's a bunch of different ones we could talk about. Just to name a few, I think that even though fairly young kids can have strategies like in those famous marshmallow experiments, they do these really cute things like close their eyes or they turn around or, you know, and those are all self-control strategies. I'm not going to eat the marshmallow if I don't see it. But as you get older and get more of this narrative skill, you start to understand like specifically what works for you better. Effective personal strategies for one person might not be as effective for another person. You might get to know what your personal triggers and temptations are. I mean, it takes a while sometimes to figure that out. And I think this narrative reasoning helps us put together that, oh, the last time I, you know, was having a really bad day and was, you know, tempted with this thing, it didn't go so well because I hadn't planned ahead or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then I think when you get to the sort of more robust, like life story capability, you have even more strategies because you can think about your life's goals, who you want to be, how you want your life to go. And some strategies might actually really require that. So for people to overcome certain kinds of addictions and things like that, they might need to be thinking in terms of those kinds of, you know, big goals and how they want their life to go. A couple of other things that I think it can do for self-control is that when psychologists talk about some self-control strategies, there's actually a co-authored paper by Angela Duckworth, Tamar Gendler, and Gross, who's a philosopher. And they talk about how one strategy of self-control might be a kind of cognitive change or reappraisal of a situation. Mm-hmm. So for instance, if a student is having trouble staying focused and self-controlled on their homework, they might reframe it or reappraise it as an opportunity. I think that's the example they give. Mm-hmm. And my thought is that if you didn't have some narrative know-how, you wouldn't be able to think of homework as an opportunity. Like seeing homework as an opportunity requires you to think about where things are going in the future, right, and requires you to think about context. It requires you to think about like, oh, I want this opportunity because I want to have these choices later and, you know, things like that. So some of these self-control strategies really require us to be thinking about, you know, things in the future. So those are just some of the kinds of things I think are going on with self-control and development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking about this just the other day. My son's trying to learn algebra and is having a hard time fitting algebra into his narrative.
Yes. Why do I need to learn this? Yes.
Yeah.
That's a very common one.
Yeah. Well, the way that you connect narrative to moral responsibility is by looking at reasons responsive theories and arguing that narrative capacity is essential to our sensitivity to reasons. Longtime listeners of the podcast may recall that we've talked about reasons responsive theories in our conversation with Michael McKenna back in the second season of the podcast. But for those who aren't familiar, could you describe what makes a theory a reasons responsiveness theory of moral responsibility?
Yeah, sure. And I won't do nearly as great a job as Michael McKenna, but I will just sort of say in general, it's kind of the idea that in order to be morally responsible, you have to be sensitive to the reasons that you have. And some of those reasons are provided by, you know, the world around you. And I like John Fisher's way of doing it in terms of kind of these two pieces. There's receptivity to reasons, mm-hmm. and then there's reactivity. So receptivity is like, can you recognize the reasons there are for doing something? So a really little kid might not recognize all the reasons that, you know, it's bad to hit the cat or something. They might recognize some of them. They might recognize that like, oh, whenever I hit the cat, you know, I get yelled at or something. But they might not recognize that like, oh, this is a creature that can feel pain and you're harming, you know, that kind of thing. So that's part of receptivity. reactivity is, you know, maybe you recognize the reasons, but you have trouble carrying that out in your actions. And often I think that's spelled out in terms of things like compulsions and phobias and things like that, where you might see a really good reason to do something. So I have a kind of silly example, but I'm really fearful of spiders for no rational reason, because mm-hmm. most of the ones that we have in North America are not that dangerous. And the ones that I'm particularly afraid of are not dangerous. Mm-hmm. But suppose that somebody gave me a really good reason to let a tarantula crawl on my head. Like they're going to give me a lot of money or something that I need. I don't know. I don't know if that'd be some sort of yeah. thing that it's like a really good reason to do it. And there's no reason not to, because that tarantula is not going to harm me in any way. But my phobia is such that I don't think I can respond to that reason. I don't think I could actually take that money and like let them put that tarantula on my head. Like, I just don't think I could do that. Other examples might be things like the classic examples that philosophers use are often things like kleptomania. Mm-hmm. So maybe somebody has a compulsion to steal, even though the reasons for not stealing are really obvious and the reasons against stealing are really good, but they just can't seem to help themselves. So they're not reacting to their reasons properly. So in those cases, they don't have the kind of freedom that we're typically and moral responsibility that we're typically concerned with.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've talked a little bit about how children develop narrative capacity. Could you now say how this helps with developing a sensitivity to reasons?
Yeah, so I think that the general story is when you start to get this narrative know-how, the kinds of reasons that you're going to be more sensitive to are going to have to do with action and consciousness, you know, the landscapes of action and consciousness, mm-hmm. like we talked about before. So if I have a better understanding of other people's intentions and desires and beliefs and behaviors, that's going to add to my the range of reasons that I can recognize. So for instance, if I come to understand intentions such that like I think a person intends to harm me, then that provides me with reasons to avoid them or something like that. So knowing that person's intentions is giving me the ability to recognize this reason. And I think narrative know-how may play a big role in our understanding other people's intentions. Mm-hmm. And there are philosophers like Daniel Hutto and Sean Gallagher that talk about sort of folk psychology in terms of narrative, or empathy or perspective switching in terms of narrative. Mm-hmm. And so there's some reason to think that this idea of understanding somebody else's point of view and what they want or believe has something to do with these narrative skills.
Yeah.
I also think it helps me understand the context of actions. So if you do something for me, I might understand it as an act of forgiveness because I understand the narrative context of that. I understand that, you know, there was something I did to you and you needed to forgive me for. And so perhaps something that you do, I interpret as an act of forgiveness. And so that might affect the reasons that I recognize or respond to when I react to your act of forgiveness. Mm-hmm. So I'll have different reasons for how I respond to you if I can understand that what you were doing was trying to forgive me. So that will give me sort of additional reasons. I also think that, you know, if you think back to the self-control stuff, one of the things about narrative know-how that's really interesting is that there's kind of a connection to mental time travel. And Jeanette Kennett and Steve Matthews have some really great stuff about mental time travel and responsibility and narrative that I think is really helpful here. But my thought is that you're going to, if you can see yourself in the past or the future, that's going to also change your sensitivity to reason. So I think this is an example from the psychologist Alison Gopnik, but she's something like, if suppose that I'm going out somewhere, if I can't think about how I'm going to feel in the future, that might affect my decision of whether I bring a coat with me. Because like, if I know, like, suppose it's not cold now, but I know that it's going to be cold when the play lets out or whatever, I'll bring a coat with me. And so I have to think about like, oh, I don't like being cold, and me in the future is going to be cold if, you know, if I don't bring this coat. And so that gives me reasons. But it requires that narrative kind of ability to connect these events together in a meaningful way. Mm-hmm. And it also helps me like bolster my ability to respond, not just to recognize reasons, but to also respond to reasons, because I can pay better attention to, look, this is how you're going to feel in the future. Mm-hmm. And so it can help me, you know, maybe stop procrastinating or something. I don't know. That's a tough one. But, you know, maybe I can say, oh, well, I know that in the future, I'm going to be really happy that I have this stuff done. And so I can kind of bolster my reactivity to my reasons for getting it done.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, you've suggested that using this lens of narrative can help explain why psychopaths are unlike morally responsible agents. So could you say what's different in the case of the psychopath?
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting literature about psychopathy, and I'm sure it will change as we go through time a bit. But one thing to wonder about is psychopaths do understand other people's intentions and beliefs and desires and things to a certain extent, because they can use that, as Shoemaker talks about, David Shoemaker talks about how they can use that to manipulate people. Right. They know, mm-hmm. if they know you're going to be scared of something or you're going to believe something, they can use that against you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But we might still think they don't understand the so-called landscape of consciousness, because they do have some standard deficiencies that make it harder for them to really understand what's going on. So some of those are, they're really deficient in affect. So they have much less fear response, and lots of other sort of emotions are tamped down. And so some people have suggested, so like philosopher Victoria McGeer suggests that they don't really see people as fully real because they have this more outsider status, because they don't really get it. Like they know that you're going to feel fear at a certain thing, but they don't really know what that feels like, because they don't feel very much fear or something. Yeah. So it's there's that kind of deficiency, and maybe they don't see this landscape of consciousness. Other philosophers and psychologists talk about how they really seem to lack the ability to mentally time travel the way that mm-hmm. typical people with narrative capacities can do. So they just seem to jump all over the place or make up stories or go with their immediate impulses instead of thinking about, you know, future goals and things like that. David Shoemaker says it's like they see the world just in terms of the strongest desire and not in terms of like outside values. And so there's those reasons to think that they don't quite understand that what they're doing now could be understood in the context of other events. It's really just, do I want to do this now? And doing that now. Another thing that I think is really fascinating about psychopaths is something that Heidi Maybaum wrote a really interesting article in Eon magazine. And in this article, she talks about how, although psychopaths are definitely deficient in empathy, and that's kind of their famous deficiency, is that they don't care about others. They don't feel your pain, or they don't worry about your distress. They seem to have normal EEG responses to people in distress at first. So their initial responses are the same, but then they turn it off much more quickly. And I thought that was really fascinating. Yeah. I thought, well, why is that? So, you know, we've been thinking that it was that they just couldn't have that response, but they have it and then just turn it off. And I don't know the answer to this question, but you know, it's fun to speculate about. And one thing that I think that could be happening is that if you see somebody in distress, but it doesn't mean anything to you, then that sort of instinctive reaction, like, why would you maintain that reaction? I mean, I feel like a typical person seeing somebody in distress, that means something to them because they understand certain things about, you know, the context of that. They understand that, you know, they wouldn't want to be in that situation. They understand that that's a person who, you know, is in pain or whatever. And so I feel like maybe they just turn it off so quickly because there's really nothing to sustain it. It's just kind of a passing thing because they don't have this kind of narrative sense.
Interesting.
Neil Levy has a lot of interesting stuff on psychopathy, and he talks about how they seem to fail to understand that other persons have lives. And I think that's very close to what I would say, is that they don't really understand that other people have stories. Like, they don't think in terms of, you know, how there's a whole context here, and that if you do something to this person, that's depriving them of their goals and interests, or that their interests matter to them because they have these particular things they want to do, just like you do, and that sort of thing. That they just don't seem to process life in that kind of narrative way. So that might have some sort of effect on their ability to recognize the same kind of moral reasons that that a sort of typical adult could recognize.
Do you have a theory on where the breakdown comes in? So a typical case, we were talking about developmental psychology and how children develop their narrative capacity. So is there a case where it, or a theory of where that breakdown happens for the case of psychopaths?
Oh, that's a great question. No, I don't really know. I mean, my very limited understanding of psychopathy is that it typically starts very young. But I don't know sort of much more than that. I don't know where that, you know, if you were to go back to that timeline of, you know, they know this by 1 to 3, they know this by 5, they know this, but I don't know. I would assume that there's some typical abilities to do the problem resolution story structure, just, you know, in terms of traditional elementary school education type stuff. But I don't know exactly sort of where in their psychological development that, that the sort of biggest difference would come in between psychopathy and a sort of typical adult. It's a good question.
Well, you've argued that your account of the role of narrative capacity and moral responsibility can actually help the reasons responsiveness theorists out a little bit. There are a couple of phenomena that you think that are usually seen as difficulties for the reasons responsiveness camp, but that this kind of helps to show what's going on in those cases. So I'll ask about one, and then Matt will ask about the other. So the first has to do with disharmony within an agent, like when an agent is alienated from their own motives, and this seems to undermine their freedom. Could you explain this problem in a little bit more detail, and then say how your work on narrative capacity allows for an explanation of that phenomenon?
Yeah, so I got this this idea from an article by Michael McKenna and Chad von Schulent, who talk about, you know, sort of there are these mesh theories of responsibility, or sometimes people talk about deep self or hierarchical or whatever, things like Harry Frankfurt's classic second order volitions and things. And those kinds of theories seem to be explaining what's going wrong inside when there's some sort of lack of freedom, and they tend to explain why and how somebody's alienated from their own motive. But reasons responsive views, it's not so much that they don't have room to do that. It's just that without sort of supplementing them with something, it doesn't give you the explanation from the inside. It just says, well, if somebody is not free, there must be a problem with reactivity or receptivity. And in the case of disharmony within an agent, it's probably a reactivity problem. But I don't think reasons responsiveness views on their own don't really explain or illuminate that. Like, well, why is the person having trouble with reactivity? And so I think that if you sort of look at the narrative know-how stuff, you can think about how if I'm alienated from my motive, so you could look at Frankfurt's classic unwilling drug addict. He's an unwilling narcotics addict, and this person hates the fact that they're addicted to this drug, and they know that this addictive desire is going to lead them to take the drug, and they're alienated from that motive, and they feel like that motive is violating them somehow. It's like not them acting. It's this, you know, it's this disharmony. And I think that if I'm alienated from a motive like that, it's because I think it's playing a role in my story that I don't want it to play. It's really only in virtue of what a motive and an action mean in the context of my life that makes me feel alienated. So I wouldn't feel alienated from a motive if I wasn't thinking in terms of the context of my life. So for instance, Frankfurt's wanton addict is the person who just doesn't care which motive prevails. And so they're not really thinking about like what they, you know, what they want their will to be. Well, why do we think about what we want our will to be? We think about what we want our will to be because we think about how we want our story to go, how we want our life to go, how we want to fulfill certain goals that are inconsistent with this action or this motive. And so I think that the narrative view can kind of fill in some of that internal stuff in a way.
Yeah, very cool. Another issue for traditional reasons responsive theories concerns degrees of responsibility. Could you explain the concern about understanding degrees of blameworthiness in particular, solely in terms of difficulty, and how taking narrative capacity into account can help to explain degrees of blameworthiness?
Yeah, so I'm particularly interested, and I think what got me kind of into this is an interest in children's responsibility. And I think this is one place where it's easy for me to illustrate the problem and hopefully the solution. I think we pretty universally tend to think that children are often less blameworthy for the very same behavior than an adult would be. So, you know, the example I sometimes give is that if one child hits another child, they're less blameworthy than if I like hit the person in front of me at the grocery line or something, right? Because I mean, obviously that would be, you know, much more blameworthy for me to do than for a child. And the problem is, usually the explanation for this, we want an explanation. Why are they less blameworthy? The explanation tends to be that children are they don't have that epistemic condition of responsibility. They don't know better. So very standard traditional responsibility conditions are a control condition, which is usually all the free will stuff, and an epistemic condition, which is you have to know what you're doing, and you have to know right and wrong or something like that. And so philosophers tend to say, oh, well, children, it's easy. They're less blameworthy because they don't know better. But I don't think that really is a full explanation in a lot of cases. I think it's an explanation mm-hmm. in some cases, like the very small child who hits the cat or whatever. But I really think that kids often do know better. Mm-hmm. And some philosophers say, oh, well, you know, they're receptive to a narrower set of reasons. And I think that's sometimes true. But sometimes I think they have the same scope of reasons. So they could have all the same reasons that we have. And, you know, the same sort of general ability strategies to control themselves and things like that. But we might still feel like they're less blameworthy. And we might extend this even up to adolescence and, I don't know, maybe even beyond. And I think this has something to do with narrative, and I think it has something to do with how hard it is to do the right thing. So I think some philosophers have talked about we should look at degrees of blameworthiness in terms of how hard it is to do the right thing. And so I think people like Dan and Nelken have talked about this. Farachi and Shoemaker have talked about it. I think there's a bunch of others who've done some really interesting stuff on that. And I like that idea. I think that makes sense. So I think that when we say that children are less blameworthy, I think it's because we think it's harder for them to do the right thing. But I don't think it's harder for them because they don't have the reasons. I think it's harder for them because not only do we have to recognize and be able to react to reasons, we have to weigh competing reasons. Mm-hmm. And I think what's harder for kids is to put the right weights on reasons. So they might have, so like a child knows that sharing is the right thing to do. They know why it's the right thing to do. They know how the person's going to feel if they don't share, all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And this is going to be, you know, different ages and whatnot. But I think that what they're going to have a harder time doing is weighing the competing reasons of sharing against their self-interested reasons. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be harder for them because they don't have the context and the perspective that narrative reasoning gives us. There's developmental psychologists who talk about how there are these mixed situations, they call them. This is coming from Manisha Pasupathy and Cecilia Wainrib. I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly. They talk about these mixed situations where there's competing moral and non-moral considerations for a child. So moral concerns would be like fairness and the needs of others, and they're weighing that against personal desires, personal goals, things like that. And these developmental psychologists talk about how children have those moral concerns very early. It's not that they don't understand those things. They know that harming others is wrong, and they understand others' interests matter and all of that stuff. But those mixed situations get change as they go through various stages of development. So they weigh the competing concerns differently at different times of development. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know exactly why that is, but I like to think that some of these narrative skills could help in weighing things properly because they give us a kind of perspective that we don't have when we're younger. So if I think about like how I want my life to go and how the thing I do right now is going to be in the context of, you know, say how that person looks at me tomorrow, those kinds of narrative skills might have a bearing on how important I think it is to treat them well today. So I might be thinking more about who I want to be or about how I want my relationship with this person to go. And I understand those are maybe more self-interested reasons, but it seems that without the narrative skills, it's a lot harder to be able to feel the force sometimes of the moral reasons. And so it's harder to do the right thing. Whereas I think a typical adult, they might not even really think twice about it. The other reasons might be very sort of pushed way down on the list. And if they're not, then we say, well, that's a case of moral wrongness. They should have known to weigh that more heavily. And they do know better. They do know how to weigh that more heavily. But I don't think we say that about children. I think we say they just don't get it yet. Like, they just don't have the perspective to fully understand this in a larger context.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Could it just be as simple as you get older, you're just gaining more experience and practice doing this?
Yeah. I think that's always a really great question. And that seems like that would have to be the case. The only question I find myself asking about that is, so is it the case that we're always kind of adding to our experience, and I almost wonder, are we going to say that, you know, a person who's had more experience and practice is always, you know, more blameworthy by a degree than, you know, so like, is the 50-year-old more responsible than the 40-year-old, and, you know, that kind of, or more blameworthy? And so that's my only sort of sticking point there. I mean, because surely I think perspective and experience just over time and over practice makes a big difference. But I also think there's sort of something about, there's almost a more of a delineation between somebody who's gone through adolescence and done sort of developed those narrative skills, had some time to put them into use, and then maybe finally as a young adult can have the perspective. I mean, I think that, you know, sometimes people will say, once you're 30, you don't have any more excuses or something. you know, then you should know better, right? So it feels like there's a point at which it becomes a little more equal, and it's not entirely dependent on, you know, racking up the years of experience. It's more of a kind of developmental milestone that had to be passed. But certainly I think, I feel like I certainly see things differently now than I did 10 years ago or 15 years ago or things like that. So certainly that's got to make some difference in the reasons that we recognize.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Megan. This has been great. Where can listeners go to follow your work?
Thank you so much. So I think probably the best place is, you know, either to look on Phil Papers or Phil People, or to go to the Davidson College site. And the philosophy department page has faculty pages. So it's davidson.edu/people/Megan-Griffith. And you can find my CV and just a kind of description of what I'm interested in.
Great. And we'll link that in the show notes for the episode too.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks again, Megan.
Thank you.
In our next episode, we'll talk about neuroethics and free will, and our guest will be Josh May, professor of philosophy and psychology at the University of Alabama, Birmingham.